The Nebulae Coat by John Meade Faulkner. Chapter 9. Among the letters which the postman brought to Bellevue Lodge on the morning following these remarkable events was an envelope which possessed a dreadful fascination. It bore a little coronet stamped in black upon the flap, and Edward Westray, Esquire, Bellevue Lodge, Collern, written on the front in a bold and clear hand. But this was not all, for low in the left corner was the inscription, Blandimer. A single word, yet fraught with so mystical an import, that it set Anastasia's heart beating fast as she gave it to her aunt to be taken upstairs with the architect's breakfast. "There is a letter for you, sir, from Lord Blandimer," Miss Joliffe said, as she put down the tray on the table. But the architect only grunted, and went on with ruler and compass at the plan with which he was busy. Miss Joliffe would have been more than woman had she not felt a burning curiosity to know the contents of so important a missive, and to leave a nobleman's letter neglected on the table seemed to her a little short of sacrilege. Never had breakfast taken longer to lay, and still there was the letter lying by the tin cover which, so near is grandeur to our dust, concealed a simple bloater. Poor Miss Joliffe made a last effort ere she left the room to bring Westray to a proper appreciation of the situation. "There is a letter for you, sir. I think it is from Lord Blandimer." "Yes, yes," the architect said sharply. "I will attend to it presently." And so she retired, routed. Westray's nonchalance had been in part assumed. He was anxious to show that he, at any rate, could rise superior to artificial distinctions of rank, and was no more to be impressed by peers than peasants. He kept up this philosophic indifference, even after Miss Joliffe left the room. For he took life very seriously, and felt his duty towards himself to be at least as important as that towards his neighbors. Resolution lasted till the second cup of tea, and then he opened the letter.
"Dear Sir," it began, "I understood from you yesterday that the repairs to the north transept of Collern Minster are estimated to cost £7,800. This charge I should like to bear myself, and thus release for other purposes of restoration the sum already collected. I am also prepared to undertake whatever additional outlay is required to put the whole building in a state of substantial repair. Will you kindly inform Sir George Farquhar of this, and ask him to review the scheme of restoration as modified by these considerations? I shall be in Collern on Saturday next, and hope I may find you at home if I call about 5 in the afternoon, and that you may then have time to show me the church. I am, dear sir, very truly yours, Blandimer."
Westray had scanned the letter so rapidly that he knew its contents by intuition rather than by the more prosaic method of reading. Nor did he reread it several times, as is generally postulated by important communications in fiction. He simply held it in his hand, and crumpled it unconsciously while he thought. He was surprised, and he was pleased at the wider vista of activity that Lord Blandimer's offer opened, and pleased that he should be chosen as the channel through which an announcement of such gravity was to be made. He felt, in short, that pleasurable and confused excitement, that mental inebriation, which unexpected good fortune is apt to produce in any except the strongest minds, and went down to Mr. Charnall's room, still crumpling the letter in his hand. The bloater was left to waste its sweetness on the morning air. "I have just received some extraordinary news," he said as he opened the door. Mr. Charnall was not altogether unprepared, for Miss Joliffe had already informed him that a letter from Lord Blandimer had arrived from Mr. Westray. So he only said, "Ah, in a tone which implied compassion for the lack of mental balance which allowed Westray to be so easily astonished, and added, "Ah, yes," as a manifesto that no sublunary catastrophe could possibly astonish him. Mr. Sharnall. But Westray's excitement was cold waterproof, and he read the letter aloud with much jubilation. "Well," said the organist, "I don't see much in it. £7,000 is nothing to him. When we have done all that we ought to do, we are unprofitable servants." "It isn't only £7,000. Don't you see? He gives carte blanche for repairs in general. Why, it may be £30,000 or £40,000, or even more." "Don't you wish you may get it?" the organist said, raising his eyebrows and shutting his eyelids. Westray was nettled. "Oh, I think it's mean to sneer at everything the man does. We abused him yesterday as a niggard. Let us have the grace today to say we were mistaken." He was afflicted with the over-scrupulosity of a refined but strictly limited mind, and his conscience smote him. "I, at any rate, was quite mistaken," he went on. "I quite misinterpreted his hesitation when I mentioned the cost of the transept repairs." "Your chivalrous sentiments do you the greatest credit," the organist said, "and I congratulate you on being able to change your ideas so quickly. As for me, I prefer to stick to my first opinion. It is all humbug. Either he doesn't mean to pay, or else he has some plan of his own to push. I wouldn't touch his money with a barge pole." "Oh, no, of course not," Westray said, with the exaggerated sarcasm of a schoolboy in his tone. "If he was to offer £1,000 to restore the organ, you wouldn't take a penny of it." "He hasn't offered £1,000 yet," rejoined the organist, "and when he does, I'll send him away with a flea in his ears." "That's a very encouraging announcement for would-be contributors," Westray sneered. "They ought to come forward very strongly after that. Well, I must get on with some copying," the organist said dryly. And Westray went back to the bloater. If Mr. Sharnall was thus pitiably wanting in appreciation of a munificent offer, the rest of Collarn made no pretense of imitating his example. Westray was too elated to keep the good news to himself, nor did there appear, indeed, to be any reason for making a secret of it. So he told the foreman Mason, and Mr. Janeway the clerk, and Mr. Newt the curate, and lastly Canon Parkin the rector, whom he certainly ought to have told the first of all. Thus, before the carillon of St. Sepulchre's played New Sabbath at 3 o'clock that afternoon, the whole town was aware that the new Lord Blandimer had been among them, and had promised to bear the cost of restoring the great minster of which they were all so proud. So very much more proud, when their pride entailed no sordid considerations of personal subscription. Canon Parkin was ruffled. Mrs. Parkin perceived it when he came in to dinner at 1 o'clock, but being a prudent woman, she did not allude directly to his ill humor, though she tried to dispel it by leading the conversation to topics which experience had shown her were soothing to him. Among such, the historic visit of Sir George Farquhar and the deference which he had paid to the rector's suggestions occupied a leading position. But the mention of the great architect's name was a signal for a fresh exhibition of vexation on her husband's part.
"I wish," he said, "that Sir George would pay a little more personal attention to the work at the minster. His representative, this Mr. Westray, besides being, I fear, very inexperienced and deficient in architectural knowledge, is a most conceited young man, and constantly putting himself forward in an unbecoming way. He came to me this morning with an exceedingly strange communication, a letter from Lord Blandimer." Mrs. Parkin laid down her knife and fork. "A letter from Lord Blandimer?" she said in unconcealed amazement. "A letter from Lord Blandimer to Mr. Westray."
"Yes," the rector went on, losing some of his annoyance in the pleasurable consciousness that his words created a profound sensation.
"A letter in which his lordship offers to bear, in the first place, the cost of the repairs of the north transept, and afterwards to make good any deficiency in the funds required for the restoration of the rest of the fabric. Of course, I am very loath to question any action taken by a member of the upper house, but at the same time I am compelled to characterize the proceeding as most irregular. That such a communication should be made to a mere clerk of the works, instead of to the rector and duly appointed guardian of the sacred edifice, is so grave a breach of propriety that I am tempted to veto the matter entirely, and to refuse to accept this offer." His face wore a look of sublime dignity, and he addressed his wife as if she were a public meeting. "Rua Caelum." Canon Parkin was not to be moved a hair's breadth from the line traced by propriety and rectitude. He knew in his inmost heart that under no possible circumstances would he have refused any gift that was offered him. Yet his own words had about them so heroic a ring that for a moment he saw himself dashing Lord Blandimer's money on the floor, as early Christians had flung to the wind that pinch of incense that would have saved them from the lions.
"I think I must refuse this offer," he repeated.
Mrs. Parkin knew her husband intimately, more intimately perhaps than he knew himself, and had an additional guarantee that the discussion was merely academic, in the certainty that, even were he really purposed to refuse the offer, she would not allow him to do so. Yet she played the game and feigned to take him seriously.
"I quite appreciate your scruples, my dear. They are just what anyone who knew you would expect. It is a positive affront that you should be told of such a proposal by this impertinent young man. And Lord Blandimer has so strange a reputation himself that one scarcely knows how far it is right to accept anything from him for sacred purposes. I honor your reluctance. Perhaps it would be right for you to decline this proposal, or at any rate to take time for consideration."
The rector looked furtively at his wife. He was a little alarmed at her taking him so readily at his word. He had hoped that she would be dismayed, that she could have brought proper arguments to bear to shake his high resolve.
"Ah, your words have unwittingly reminded me of my chief difficulty in refusing. It is the sacred purpose which makes me doubt my own judgment. It would be a painful reflection to think that the temple should suffer by my refusing this gift. Maybe I should be yielding to my own petulance or personal motives if I were to decline. I must not let my pride stand in the way of higher obligations."
He concluded in his best pulpit manner, and the farce was soon at an end. It was agreed that the gift must be accepted, that proper measures should be taken to rebuke Mr. Westray's presumption, as he had no doubt induced Lord Blandimer to select so improper a channel of communication, and that the rector should himself write direct to thank the noble donor. So, after dinner, Canon Parkin retired to his study and composed a properly fulsome letter, in which he attributed all the noblest possible motives and qualities to Lord Blandimer, and invoked all the most unctuously conceived blessings upon his head. And at tea-time the letter was perused and revived by Mrs. Parkin, who added some finishing touches of her own,
especially a preamble which stated that Canon Parkin had been informed by the clerk of the works that Lord Blandimer had expressed a desire to write to Canon Parkin to make a certain offer, but had asked the clerk of the works to find out first whether such an offer would be acceptable to Canon Parkin, and a peroration which hoped that Lord Blandimer would accept the hospitality of the rectory on the occasion of his next visit to Collern. The letter reached Lord Blandimer at Fording the next morning, as he sat over a late breakfast with a Virgil open on the table by his coffee cup. He read the rector's stilted periods without a smile, and made a mental note that he would at once send a specially civil acknowledgment. Then he put it carefully into his pocket, and turned back to the De Patrii Indigetes et Romule Vestaque Mater of the First Georgic, which he was committing to memory, and banished the invitation so completely from his mind that he never thought of it again till he was in Collern a week later. Lord Blandimer's visit, and the offer which he had made for the restoration of the church, formed the staple of Collern conversation for a week. All those who had been fortunate enough to see or to speak with him discussed him with one another and compared notes. Scarcely a detail of his personal appearance, of his voice or manner, escaped them. And so infectious was this interest that some who had never seen him at all were misled by their excitement into narrating how he had stopped them in the street to ask the way to the architect's lodgings, and how he had made so many striking and authentic remarks that it was wonderful that he had ever reached Bellevue Lodge at all that night. Clark Janeway, who was sorely chagrined to think he should have missed an opportunity of distinguished converse, declared that he had felt the stranger's gray eyes go through and through him like a knife, and had only made believe to stop him entering the choir, in order to convince himself, by the other's masterful insistence, that his own intuition was correct. He had known all the time, he said, that he was speaking to none other than Lord Blandimer. Westray thought the matter important enough to justify him in going to London to consult Sir George Farquhar as to the changes in the scheme of restoration which Lord Blandimer's munificence made possible. But Mr. Charnall, at any rate, was left to listen to Miss Joliffe's recollections, surmises, and panegyrics. In spite of all the indifference which the organist had affected when he first heard the news, he showed a surprising readiness to discuss the affair with all comers, and exhibited no trace of his usual impatience with Miss Joliffe, so long as she was talking of Lord Blandimer. To Anastasia it seemed as if he could talk of nothing else, and the more she tried to check him by her silence or by change of subject, the more bitterly did he return to the attack. The only person to exhibit no interest in this unhappy nobleman, who had outraged propriety by offering to contribute to the restoration of the minster, was Anastasia herself. And even tolerant Miss Joliffe was moved to chide her niece's apathy in this particular. "I do not believe it becomes us, love, young or old, to take so little notice of great and good deeds. Mr. Charnall is, I fear, discontented with the station of life to which it has pleased Providence to call him, and I am less surprised at his not always giving praise where praise should be given. But with the young it is different. I am sure if anyone had offered to restore Widcombe Church when I was a girl, and especially a nobleman, I should have been as delighted, or nearly as delighted, as if I had been given a new frock." She altered the "as if he had given me," which was upon her tongue, because the proposition, even for purposes of illustration, that a nobleman could ever have offered her a new frock, seemed to have in itself something of the scandalous and unfitting. "I should have been delighted, but dear me, in those days people were so blind as never to think of restorations. We used to sit in quite comfortable seats every Sunday, with cushions and hassocks, and the aisles were paved with flagstones, simple worn flagstones, and none of the caustic tiles which look so much more handsome, though I am always afraid I am going to slip,
and glad to be off them. They are so hard and shiny. Church matters were very behindhand then. All round the walls were tablets that people had put up to their relations, white caskets on black marble slates, and urns and cherubs' heads, and just opposite where I used to sit, a poor lady, whose name I have forgotten, weeping under a willow tree. No doubt they were very much out of place in the sanctuary, as the young gentleman said in his lecture on how to make our churches beautiful in the town hall last winter. He called them mural blisters, my dear. But there was no talk of removing them in my young days, and that was, I dare say, because there was no one to give them money for it. But now here is this good young nobleman, Lord Blandimer, come forward so handsomely, and I have no doubt at all Colin will be much improved ere long. We are not meant to loll at our devotions, as the lecturer told us. That was his word, to loll, and they will be sure to take away the bays and hassocks, though I do hope there will be a little strip of something on the seats. The bare wood is apt to make one ache sometimes. I should not say it to anyone else in the world but you, but it does make me ache a little sometimes. And when the caustic is put down in the aisle, I shall take your arm, my dear, to save me from slipping. Here is Lord Blandimer going to do all this for us, and you do not show yourself in the least grateful. It is not becoming in a young girl. Dear aunt, what would you have me do? I cannot go and thank him publicly in the name of the town. That would be still more unbecoming. And I am sure I hope they will not do all the dreadful things in the church that you speak of. I love the old monuments, and like lolling much better than bare forms. So she would laugh the matter off. But if she could not be induced to talk of Lord Blandimer, she thought of him all the more, and rehearsed again and again in daydreams and in nightdreams every incident of that momentous Saturday afternoon, from the first bars of the overture, when he had revealed in so easy and simple a way that he was none other than Lord Blandimer, to the ringing down of the curtain when he turned to look back, to that glance when his eyes had seemed to meet hers, although she was hidden behind a blind, and he could not have guessed that she was there. Westray came back from London with the scheme of restoration reconsidered and amplified in the light of altered circumstances, and with a letter for Lord Blandimer, in which Sir George Farquhar hoped that the munificent donor would fix a day on which Sir George might come down to Colerne to offer his respects, and to discuss the matter in person. Westray had looked forward all the week to the appointment which he had with Lord Blandimer for 5 o'clock on the Saturday afternoon, and had carefully thought out the route which he would pursue in taking him round the church. He returned to Bellevue Lodge at 4:45, and found his visitor already awaiting him. Miss Joliffe was, as usual, at her Saturday meeting, but Anastasia told Westray that Lord Blandimer had been waiting for more than half an hour. "I must apologize, my lord, for keeping you waiting," Westray said as he went in. "I feared I had made some mistake in the time of our meeting, but I see it was 5 that your note named." And he held out the open letter which he had taken from his pocket. "The mistake is entirely mine," Lord Blandimer admitted with a smile as he glanced at his own instructions. "I fancied I had said 4 o'clock, but I have been very glad of a few minutes to write 1 or 2 letters." "We can post them on our way to church. They will just catch the mail." "Ah, then I must wait till tomorrow. There are some enclosures which I have not ready at this moment." They set out together for the Minster, and Lord Blandimer looked back as they crossed the street. "The house has a good deal of character," he said, "and might be made comfortable enough with a little repair. I must ask my agent to see what can be arranged. It does not do me much credit as landlord in its present state." "Yes, it has a good many interesting features," Westray answered. "You know its history, of course. I mean that it was an old inn." He had turned round as his companion turned, and for an instant thought he saw something moving behind the blind in Mr. Charnall's room.
but he must have been mistaken. Only Anastasia was in the house, and she was in the kitchen, for he had called to her as they went out to say that he might be late for tea. End of part 1 of chapter 9.